Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
In a clinic the other day, getting my second vaccination shot, strangely, a nurse asked, I thanked the nurse for her work and she said, oh, thank you. And what do you do? I said, I'm a lawyer. And the first question she asked me, and this is in a clinic in Northwest Western Australia, was, what do you think about Julian Assange? And I was so surprised to hear her ask that question.
Wow.
Because she didn't realize that I was his lawyer. And I said, well, a lot actually, because he's my client. And everyone in the room stopped. She insisted on giving me a hug. And these were people who are everyday Australians who didn't know they were going to bump into me. And their unanimous response was outrage at the fact he was still in prison and outrage that the Australian government wasn't doing more.
That's Barrister Jen Robinson, lawyer for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. This is Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. The Australian government may not be pressing for the release of Julian Assange from prison, but a number of parliamentarians from across the party divide believe the pursuit of him by the US should stop. Opposition leader Anthony Albanese and Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce are two such MPs. Julian Assange is currently in prison in the UK, despite defeating a US extradition request. He is now awaiting a US appeal. If they succeed, he faces espionage charges and, if convicted, the prospect of a very long jail term. All because he published classified information leaked by whistleblower Chelsea Manning, which included the so-called collateral murder video, the Afghan war diaries, Iraq war logs, and millions of diplomatic cables. This Zoom panel discussion, organised by the Melbourne Writers Festival, features three speakers who believe Julian Assange should be freed and the charges against him dropped. On the panel is Barrister Julian Burnside QC, a former president of Liberty Victoria, who's acted pro bono in many human rights cases. Scott Ludlam, formerly a senator and deputy leader of the Australian Greens, and Jen Robinson, barrister at Doughty Street Chambers in London, who begins by discussing the possibility of Julian Assange being extradited to the US.
Well, of course, the threat of extradition hasn't yet been lifted because the United States government is continuing to appeal despite the fact we won the extradition case in January. But Julian's now been in a high security prison for more than 2.5 years, and before that, of course, 7.5 years in the Ecuadorian embassy. So we're talking about an Australian citizen who has been under significant restrictions on his liberty without ever having been convicted of a crime. He is in a very isolated situation in Belmarsh Prison. As I said, it's a high security prison. And because of the COVID pandemic, the conditions within the prison have been incredibly difficult. He went for months and months and months on end without seeing a visitor, whether legal or personal. He hasn't been able to hug his children until just recently. So he's in a very difficult state, and that was confirmed by the judge in her ruling on his mental health in the judgment.
So let's just go back to that US application to extradite Julian Assange. It was denied by the UK courts early this year. The magistrate said he would be at risk of suicide if he were extradited to the US. This was a win for you, a win for him, a legal victory, but a victory not based on the grounds that you were after. Can you explain this?
So the extradition outcome in the ruling in January is what I would call the right outcome, but for all the wrong reasons. We ran a number of challenges against the US extradition request, including challenges that related to the free speech aspects and the need to protect freedom of speech, because of course WikiLeaks is publishing information in the public interest, which has won journalism awards the world over. And these are the very same publications for which he's being sought for 175 years in prison. The judge refused all of our grounds on free speech and only found on the very narrow grounds, as you mentioned, that it would be oppressive to extradite him to the United States because of his particular mental health condition, his depression, and the likelihood he would commit suicide once placed in the prison conditions in the United States. Now, that is a win for us. And if it prevents him from going to the United States, then we'll take it. And that's why we will continue to fight the US appeal. However, for any other publisher and journalist in the United Kingdom, if you publish truthful information, you could face extradition and prosecution in a foreign power for publishing the truthful information about that foreign power. There are very few journalists and editors who would be in the same position medically that Julian is in as a result of his conditions over the past decade and his particular diagnosis. So this is a dangerous, dangerous precedent for all journalists and all editors.
Julian, what did you make of the extradition ruling in the UK and the fact that those free speech grounds were not accepted by the court?
I thought it was very surprising, and I rather hope that there'll be a cross appeal in which the free speech grounds, as you say, and the other arguments are all advanced, because they struck me, as Jen Robinson said, they struck me as being the really worthwhile reasons for not extraditing him. But I guess any refusal to extradite is better than none. I think we in Australia should be conscious of the fact that Assange is an Australian, he is a publisher, and he has done great work, and our government has done nothing to help him, nothing at all. Now, to be an Australian out of this country and be in that sort of difficulty and get no help from your government is outrageous.
Scott, if I can bring you in, what is at stake with this Assange prosecution and the fact that the US has pursued him for so long? What human rights principles, I suppose, do you see as central to this?
I kind of read it in two different dimensions. On the one hand, what's at stake is quite literally the life of an Australian citizen, an Australian publisher, an Australian journalist, whose mental and physical health is at enormous risk because the Biden administration has chosen to continue Donald Trump's prosecution and because the Australian government's done less than nothing to raise this issue with the United States government. So there's that immediate risk. The second dimension is that this case is basically a warning to other publishers. It has much wider ramifications for people doing national security journalism or other kinds of journalism publishing that powerful people may not like. That's the warning and the precedent case that's being set. If you publish this material in the public interest around the world and break these stories, we will come after you and destroy your life. And so I think it's an incredibly important test case, but we also shouldn't forget the very human and very personal dimensions of the people who are trapped in this situation right now.
Look, I'm a journalist, so I'm sympathetic, clearly, to those arguments, but could it not be argued that there is a principle that the United States government is seeking to uphold here through the prosecution, and that principle is that people should not be able to publish at will unredacted national security documents?
You mean like collateral murder?
Like collateral murder, that might be one.
What aspect of collateral murder should not have been available to the public?
Well, it's a good question. What about the other tranche of documents, the Afghan war logs, the Iraq war logs, the diplomatic cables? Julian, there is no potential problem you see with having carte blanche to publish documents like that?
I don't think Assange claims carte blanche to publish documents like that. My understanding is that they were looked at pretty carefully before they were made public. So to suggest that they've simply been made willy-nilly available to the public is simply wrong. But there's more than that. There is the fact that what he did was to receive and publish material that other people had got. Now, to be candid, I don't know how you say that a person who is in a position to publish material should withhold publication because they form a view that a government may be displeased with it. And especially if they do it in another country and they get a country like the USA jumping on them for it. How would we respond if a publisher in Australia was attacked because they said something about Rwanda, for example?
Jen, coming back to you, if Assange had just been another journalist in the UK who'd published something similar that the United States was displeased with, but he wasn't depressed and suicidal, the US would be able to extradite them. Is that correct, according to that ruling?
According to the ruling in January, that is precisely the ruling that she made and the outcome, the consequences. Basically, what the judgment says is that you are entitled from the United Kingdom, if you are sought under the Espionage Act for prosecution, you can be extradited because the United States and the UK have similar laws about the publishing of official secrets. Now, that is a dangerous precedent because, of course, the Espionage Act is different to the Official Secrets Act and there are different freedom of speech implications at play. And what must not be forgotten about this case is that the United States has actually put in their brief on oath that they will consider running an argument in the United States that because Julian is an Australian citizen, he does not benefit from constitutional protections in the First Amendment. That is a terrifying position to be setting. So while we won on a technical point to do with his mental health, the free speech implications are very clear. And I just wanted to pick up, if I can, Paul, on the point you raised earlier, which is the myth that WikiLeaks dumps material unredacted without security procedures. That is simply false. It is one that is put out in the press all the time about WikiLeaks' so-called dumping of material. As we heard in the extradition proceedings and in the evidence that we put forward in the case, WikiLeaks had security procedures and redaction procedures for the Afghan war logs material, for the Iraq war logs material, and for the diplomatic cables. In fact, the redactions of the Afghan material as published were criticised for having over-redacted the material. And in fact, you could get more information from the Pentagon than you could from the WikiLeaks disclosures. Now, I think people need to take a very serious look and question some of the messaging that comes out about WikiLeaks. And if you look at the facts and if you look at the evidence that we put before the court, it's simply not the case.
Can I just come back to what you just said there about the First Amendment not being able to be used by Assange should he be extradited and face charges in the US? So that would not be able to form part of your defence? Is that what you're saying?
Of course, if Julian were to be extradited to the United States, the First Amendment would feature front and centre in any defence case. What the US government is claiming is that because he is an Australian citizen, they will argue that he does not benefit from First Amendment protections. That is a very dangerous argument to be running, and one that should put all people, all Australians, and certainly our government, on notice of the potential risk that this Australian citizen faced if he is sent to the United States to face prosecution. And from a human rights and free speech perspective, it's dangerous for all Australian citizens, for all non-US citizens, but also this case is dangerous for the US press.
Scott, are you surprised at how persistent the United States has been in their pursuit of Julian Assange?
No, I'm not surprised at all. There are elements of the US intelligence establishment and some of the ecosystem of contractors and advisors around them who foreshadowed a decade ago what they were planning on doing. In one leaked document by Stratfor, they said shop him around multiple legal jurisdictions for 25 years. And so we're seeing that playing out, exactly what they said they were going to do. Shop him through multiple jurisdictions, appeal, run the clock down, counter-appeal. They don't care ultimately whether he's eventually prosecuted or not, because the whole time this degrading drama is playing out, Julian Assange is in a maximum security prison. It's not surprising. It's disgusting, but you couldn't say it's surprising because they foreshadowed what they would do.
Julian, would you call that, what Scott just described, an abuse of legal process?
Yes, with qualifications, I think it's an abuse of the power that they hold. I think it overlooks some fundamentals, like this really ought to be dealt with between governments. I first met Assange, or the first time I can remember meeting him, apparently I acted for him decades ago when he was a teenager.
And you can't remember?
And I don't remember that, no. But I did meet him in the Ecuadorian embassy in 2012, not long after he'd gone in. And together he and I prepared a letter to the then Labor Attorney General, who I knew personally. We set down the circumstances that he was faced with. This is when he was sought to be extradited to Sweden. Now, the problem is that Sweden had a witness lending program with America, and right back then, the American system was having a really hard go at Chelsea Manning. Assange recognized then and there that he faced the same prospect. And really, what could have happened is that the Australian government could have done a deal with the British government that he would be collected by the Australians outside the embassy and be taken directly to the airport where he could be flown back to Australia. Would have got him out of England's hair, and it would have meant he would be at least safe back in his home country. They did nothing. The Australian government did absolutely nothing. I wrote again to them when Malcolm Turnbull was the Prime Minister, and they again did nothing. So both major parties, governments in Australia, have done nothing to help him.
I'm discussing the fate of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange with his barrister, Jen Robertson, as well as Julian Burnside QC and former Green Senator Scott Ludlam. So why did Julian Assange breach his bail and take refuge in the Embassy of Ecuador in London in 2012, instead of travelling to Sweden to face questioning about sexual assault allegations?
A brief summary. He initially faced extradition proceedings in Sweden to face questioning in relation to allegations in Sweden. For many years, the Swedish authorities refused to question him in London, which is why he remained inside the embassy to protect himself from US extradition, which is precisely what happened when he was dragged out of the embassy and he was served with a US extradition request. Those charges, those allegations rather, have now been dropped. And so I think it's really important that the public understands the background to this story. And I can only recommend Scott Ludlam's essay in the Monthly, which sets out the history of this case in a really succinct and easy to understand way. I recommend it for those who want to try and catch up on the many twists and turns in this case. So in terms of the appeal where we are now, basically, so we won the case in January. She refused to extradite on the grounds it would be oppressive to send him to the United States to face prosecution because of the prison conditions and his mental health. The United States then appealed, running five different grounds of appeal. Two of those were refused by the Court of Appeal, a single judge of the Court of Appeal, and the US appealed against that decision, which was heard last month, and the court decided that all five grounds can go before the Court of Appeal. So really, it was just simply setting the stage for what this appeal will look like. It's being heard at the end of October, and the US is seeking to challenge the extradition on the basis of challenging the psychiatric evidence, which came to the conclusion of about Julian's mental health, which the judge relied upon, the various tests involved in that, the oppressive test. And also the US is now offering assurances saying that they won't send him to the prison conditions that they first had said that he would be. So we will be both challenging the US appeal, challenging the security of those assurances from the United States, because we know they're not worth the paper that they're written on. And it remains to be seen whether there will then subsequently be a cross appeal. So as Julian mentioned, because we won, it is the US government to appeal. If they are successful in their appeal, we will then have an opportunity to bring our cross appeal points.
And the other point, the other development that appears significant is that one of the key witnesses for the United States in that extradition case against Assange recently admitted that parts of his evidence were made up. He admitted this to an Icelandic newspaper, which resulted in Edward Snowden tweeting that this is the end of the case against Julian Assange. How significant is that for your case?
It is significant. As we ran many challenges to the extradition in the hearing last year, saying that the allegations that formed the basis of the United States request for extradition were misstated, exaggerated, and flat out false. Now, this witness coming forward to admit that he lied to the US prosecutors, to admit that there is no basis to the hacking allegations that are included in the indictment, show how flimsy the US case really is. And again, it simply emphasises what we've been saying all along. This case is wrong in principle. It should never have been brought, and the US ought to drop their appeal.
Look, let's come to some of the broader issues at stake here, Julian. What protections would you like to see, I suppose, in Australia for people like Assange who publish information about national security that holds governments to account, but which also reveals classified information? Do we need some sort of protection for journalists and whistleblowers, some legal protection to allow them to do this?
In my opinion, we do. They should be protected because they are journalists, because they're publishers. They should not be prosecuted merely because they have published material which may have an adverse effect on national security. So far, I don't think there's any evidence that anything published by Assange in fact had an adverse effect on national security of any country. But if all they're doing is publishing material, then I don't see how that could possibly qualify as an offence.
But Scott, be that as it may, publishing such information could potentially be problematic, could it not? So what, I suppose, limitations would there need to be on a right to publish?
To me, that feels as though it's kind of got the opposite end of the stick. Julian is a test case. He's one of the world's most important test cases, but he's not alone. We've got Australian Federal Police coming through the doors of ABC headquarters at Ultimo. We've got the Federal Police raiding News Corp journalists' homes and going through their underwear drawers. There are hundreds and hundreds of metadata requests accessed without warrant every year, looking for the sources that journalists are using to publish on, for example, our catastrophic bipartisan refugee policy. This is right through the system. There's a long tradition of work on a strong legislated or even constitutional Bill of Rights in this country. I think that's the conversation that we need to be having. Because at the moment, you know, the people that we hold in trust to inform us about what powerful institutions are up to are operating with no protections whatsoever. And we have to stop taking that on trust.
Jen, what protections exist for British journalists in this instance?
Of course, British journalists have the benefit of the European Convention of Human Rights and the Human Rights Act in the UK, which protects freedom of speech. But of course, freedom of speech is not an unlimited right, and we recognise that governments are able to regulate to protect, for example, national security. The question is where we draw that line and how we balance the public interest in protecting national security and the immense public interest in ensuring that the public understands what our governments are doing. I do think that we have a problem in Australia with our national security laws. Certainly, if you compare Australian national security laws to the Official Secrets Act, the penalties here far outweigh anything that you would see in the United Kingdom. And I think that that's something that should be at the forefront of discussion in this country in terms of the potential sanctions that our journalists face. And of course, we've been warning since 2010, you cannot distinguish between the act of what Julian did and does with WikiLeaks and what journalists do all day, every day. And so the moment that this criminal investigation was opened in the United States, it set a chilling impact across the national security journalism space in the United States. And we have been saying since then, this will be used as a precedent to go after other journalists. And that is precisely what we are seeing happening. Whether we talk about the ABC and News Corp here in Australia, whether we talk about what happened to Glenn Greenwald in Brazil, we're seeing it everywhere. And I do think that this is a huge deterrent to anyone who would put their head above the parapet and make the bold publishing decisions that WikiLeaks decided to do. So I think we must see it in that context, and that's why this case is so important. It's why it is described as the greatest threat to press freedom in the 21st century. And it's why the Australian government ought to be motivated to stand up for this citizen, because it's the right thing to do in principle if we are a liberal democracy that believes in free speech, and it is the right thing to do for our citizen.
Yes, but I think, as was just said, I spoke to Annika Smethurst last year, who lived under the Damocles sword of prosecution and possible imprisonment for a considerable time, and she spoke to me about the personal toll that took on her for reporting a plan to increase surveillance of civilians in Australia. That was the news report. And that is a small example compared to what Julian Assange faces. Julian, where do you go with this? Scott just mentioned, I know, that the Bill of Rights needs to be part of this conversation, but, you know, that debate about Bills of Rights in Australia has not had a happy history.
I agree with that, and I completely agree with Scott's point that we need a federal Bill of Rights in Australia. We really need protection of our rights as human beings. It's really, really important to bear in mind also that if any harm was done by WikiLeaks publication, and I think that's a debatable question, that harm, if any, was done because what WikiLeaks published was republished by other organs of the press, not least the one run by another Australian, Rupert Murdoch.
Do you, either of you, Scott or Julian, are you witnessing a chilling impact from those recent incidences of journalists in Australia facing the possibility of prosecution? Scott, are you seeing a reluctance in the media for journalists to take on issues like defence, national security, powerful interests because they fear the consequences of that?
The problem is we won't ever know, because a lot of these stories will just get legaled out of existence before they can go to air. So it's not that we're necessarily going to see a rash of evidence that stories are getting killed. It'll just quietly disappear. Things will stop getting published. If you look at what the journalists who were working on, you know, on the stories of war crimes in Afghanistan have been subjected to, how that story has ricocheted around the place. Given the other kinds of political pressures that the ABC is under, commercial pressures that the rest of the media landscape is under, this is just one extra complication and difficulty that's making it extremely challenging for these incredibly important stories to be told. We need these stories to be told. And that's something that, you know, outside very, very narrow parts of the US national security establishment, nobody disagrees that the WikiLeaks stories were in the public interest. Of course they were in the public interest.
Dare I say that it's not only that the stories may be legaled out of existence. Some of them involve such secret material. I mean, Bernard Collaery and Witness K are a perfect example of that. But the people who've heard of that case, because it's now prosecution, have not heard of the case of Witness J. Witness J was a former operative of ASIS. He was secretly charged, secretly tried, secretly convicted, and secretly jailed. Now, it's only by accident that anyone ever knows about his case, because everything about it was secret. It was not possible for that to be legaled out of existence, because you'd have to have got behind the wall of secrecy.
Three presidents have now had to deal with Julian Assange, Obama, Trump, and obviously now Biden. The issue that Obama faced, which Scott writes about in his very good article in The Monthly, but which has been commented upon, is the so-called New York Times problem, that what prevented Obama from going after Assange, it is said, is that how could they prosecute him and not prosecute the New York Times? This must surely still be the case, though, for the Biden administration.
Of course it is. So when we talk about the New York Times problem, it is effectively what I said earlier, which is you can't distinguish between what the New York Times does and what WikiLeaks does. And we've had very public op-eds from both the Washington Post and the New York Times editorial board saying this prosecution is criminalizing public interest journalistic practices that we have been engaging in for 20 years. The New York Times' own general counsel, David McCraw, has said that judges aren't going to be able to distinguish between WikiLeaks and the New York Times, and that is what we call the New York Times problem. Of course, that was what we say prevented Obama from going forward, and that's what sources from within the Department of Justice have in fact said. Then we had the Trump administration, which called the press the enemy of the people, who was very happy to create a problem for the New York Times and for the rest of the media, and used Julian's case, as we say, a battering ram against the rest of the press. Now we have a Biden administration, an administration who has committed itself to freedom of speech, or have said they're committed to freedom of speech, have said they're committed to closing Guantanamo, and yet they are continuing an appeal to keep in prison the person who revealed the information that was required to show the world what was wrong with Guantanamo, and a person who stands up for free speech around the world. It is a completely hypocritical position for the Biden administration to take. The answer they give us is that, unlike under the Trump administration, the DOJ, the Department of Justice, has independence under the Biden administration. But this prosecution is going to put a blight on this presidency if it is allowed to go ahead. And what is required is for the Australian government to pick up the phone to Biden and to have this conversation. And if we can't use our special relationship with the United States in this way to protect an Australian citizen, then what is it for?
Have you had any discussions with the Australian government yourself?
I have indeed, over many, many years, for the past decade, been asking the Australian government to do precisely that. The most recent meeting that I had was with Maurice Payne's office in February this year, when I made, just after we had won the extradition case, and I made two clear asks of our government. The first was to call the Biden administration and do precisely what I just said, which is to ask them to drop the appeal. In view of the fact we've won the appeal, drop the appeal and let him come home. We have political support from the Labor Party, from the Nationals and from the Greens for that position. It is only the Liberal government which is holding out on that position. The second ask we made was, in the meantime, if this appeal is going to go ahead, ask the United States to drop their opposition to bail so that at least Julian can get out of that high security prison and be with his family where he can recover and properly prepare for an appeal. We have had no indication of whether those asks have been made.
You would have put submissions in for bail after you won your extradition case. It was denied. Presumably it was denied because the courts thought that Julian Assange was a flight risk. Is that right?
Well, first it was denied because the US opposed the bail application. The grounds that were given were that he is a flight risk. Now, of course, the arguments made relate to his decision to seek asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy. He was convicted of a bail offence for that. And so the US government is citing this in their opposition to his bail. The world has changed since he sought asylum the first time. He now faces an extradition request, and the UK is the safest place for him because it's the only country in the world where we have a judicial decision saying that he cannot be extradited. So there is no reason why he would leave his young family. Don't forget he's got two small children with his partner Stella Morris in the UK, who are tiny children who have not had the benefit of being with him at all since they were born. He's not a flight risk. So it is entirely reasonable and appropriate, we say, to allow him to be released from prison, to allow him to prepare this appeal.
So, Scott, I found out from reading your article, I didn't know this actually until I read your article, that Barnaby Joyce, the Deputy Prime Minister, believes that Julian Assange should be let go now. What is stopping the Australian government from doing, as Jen suggests, in getting on the phone to the United States and saying enough is enough?
Nothing's stopping them at all. You know, that kind of back-channel diplomacy, we're not asking for the Prime Minister to put out a press statement, although it'd be nice if he did, but that kind of diplomacy is what got Melinda Taylor out of prison. It's what got Peter Gresta out of Egypt. There's nothing stopping the government doing that. It's actually relatively common if an Australian citizen finds themselves in legal jeopardy in another part of the world.
Except that something is stopping them from doing it because they're not doing it.
An absolute lack of courage. But there's nothing material or legal stopping them. There's nothing political stopping them. As Jen pointed out, they've got backing from right across the political spectrum in this country. When I spoke to Stella Morris in the course of researching the piece for The Monthly, she said the Australian government holds the key to Julian's prison cell. If they intervene on Julian's behalf, this would end. If that's all it takes, then we need the Prime Minister to just pick the phone up and then this ends.
Julian, how do you see this? I mean, we've had, for example, Julie Bishop agitating on behalf of Peter Gresta in an Egyptian prison. We had Maurice Payne agitating on behalf of James Ricketson, I think, in a Cambodian prison. I mean, Australian foreign ministers and diplomats do this all of the time, represent the interests of Australian citizens overseas. Why not in the case of Julian Assange?
That's a very good question. I do not know the answer why. It is a great tragedy, though, that Barnaby Joyce is the best person to speak up on his behalf, because whatever else you might think about Australian politics, Barnaby Joyce may not be the person you want to have on your side.
I'm in discussion with Julian Assange's barrister, Jen Robertson, former Green Senator Scott Ludlam, and barrister Julian Burnside QC. Scott, I wonder, Australia, along with Britain, have been great allies of the United States. They've stood with the United States in the war, so-called war on terror. They've served alongside them in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, in Australia, the ANZUS Treaty, you know, is an article of faith among governments. The US, it would appear, clearly want to bring Julian Assange to their court system. Could this be the reason why Australia is not prepared to pick up the phone and make certain demands on the United States? Is this part of the deal that being an ally of America involves?
Just being incredibly gutless when one of our citizens is in enormous legal danger, I don't believe most people would support that. I think it's an absolute dereliction of an Australian citizen and an important publisher who's in enormous legal difficulty. And as, you know, Jen had said a little earlier, what is the point of this alliance if we can't stick up for each other, if we can't speak plainly when necessary. So that's on Morrison now. Every single day that this goes by, this is on Morrison's head. The United States government is trying to kill Julian Assange in a US prison. And a British court has just borne that opinion out. So this has to come to an end.
So, Jen, that's the Australian government. How much pressure, though, is on the Biden administration itself from within America, from within liberals and Democrats in America who think this has been pushed too far?
I do think the Biden administration is coming under increasing pressure to drop the appeal. We've got unanimous opposition to the prosecution across the mainstream media. As I mentioned, the New York Times and the Washington Post editorial boards have spoken out against it. Unanimous support from freedom of speech and human rights groups. And I do think that as this case progresses, the Biden administration will come under further pressure. It is not in the US's interest to run this case. And it's certainly not in the interest of freedom of speech in the United States to run this case. And I hope that the Biden administration will eventually come to the position that the Obama administration did and choose not to go ahead with this.
You do wonder, you think about the august publications around the world that have made news stories on the basis of WikiLeaks information, Le Monde, Der Spiegel, The Guardian, you know, you name it, the New York Times. Have they been vocal enough about the rights and the principles of free speech around this case?
Well, as I said, the New York Times and the Washington Post have both spoken out against the prosecution, saying that it's criminalising public interest journalistic practices. But do I think they could do more? Absolutely. We have been warning about this prosecution for more than 10 years. And rather than sticking up for the principles and sticking up for Julian, these newspapers, like many in the media in Australia, have sought to other Julian and WikiLeaks as if they are somehow not quote-unquote journalists. Now, of course, this is the press shooting themselves in the foot, because freedom of speech protects journalistic practices. And the moment you start going down the path of defining who is and who is not a journalist, you are taking a very dangerous position. It's the kind of position that you see taken in China or Russia. We don't define people as a journalist or not. We define their activity. And it's the protection of that activity, which is why we talk about the New York Times problem. Julian and what WikiLeaks do is what the journalists do all day, every day. You cannot distinguish between the act of receiving and publishing information in the way that they do. Mm. And to criminalise that is to criminalise the whole press, which is why it is so important that media groups, media organisations, journalists and the unions stand up for Julian in this case. And that's why we see the International Federation of Journalists out on this.
I wonder, Scott, Julian, how much, what your appraisal is of how Australians think about Julian Assange right now. I have to admit, even in my own consciousness, the Assange matter had faded somewhat. You know, it's been one of those stories that's been bubbling on the back burner for so long. He's not on the news regularly as he once was. He's kind of forgotten about. Scott, what do you think? Do you think that the public have largely forgotten him in Australia?
No, I don't think so. If you think about it, anytime there's a significant court development involving Julian's case, it leads news bulletins right around the world, including here in Australia. He's still one of the most recognisable public figures in the world, as far as I'm aware. And I would say, even if most Australians aren't familiar with all the ins and outs of the case for how long this has been going, he is seen as something of an underdog and a fighter, which he is in this case. Two things that I think are important. Firstly, there's been a sustained campaign of disinformation that's since at least 2011, probably before that, where there's been an attempt to divert attention away from what was in the publications and focus solely on Julian's character, whether he looks after his cat in the embassy, whether he cleans his socks, whether he's a Russian agent, you know, all kinds of bizarre things that have been quite successful in diverting attention. And the second thing is, as a result of being imprisoned for more than 2.5 years, is his voice has been taken out of the debate. We don't hear from him anymore. It's all through intermediaries, through the filter of a legal process or other people, sometimes with other agendas. And I think that's an enormous shame that his voice has been silenced.
I think all the press should be collectively speaking in his support, as Jen said. I agree also with what Scott just said a moment ago. I think that we really could, in the Australian media, we could cover the issue much more attentively, and we should perhaps adopt the focus that it is that he is an Australian citizen who's at serious risk. But look, these issues just don't get much play in Australia, and I don't know why. It's a real pity. We seem to have forgotten how important it is that our press should be free and able to do what the press is supposed to be doing.
I think we touched on before the documents themselves at the heart of this matter. Perhaps it's worth reminding people they included, as we spoke of before, the so-called collateral murder video, which showed US soldiers opening fire, killing civilians in Iraq, including a Reuters war correspondent and his assistant. Two children were later seriously injured. There were the Afghan war logs, there were the Iraq war logs, there were 3 million or so diplomatic cables from the US State Department. As you've all said, no one doubts the veracity or accuracy of any of those documents. Nobody doubts that they embarrassed the US government considerably. And a few people, I think, doubt the public interest in publishing. The question, I suppose, that remains after the publication of that is this issue of when should it be legal and when should it be illegal to publish documents of this nature. You've made the case, and I think this has been widely accepted, that nobody was harmed as a result of publishing these. But people will say there needs to be some limit on what is published. The governments need, some people will say, to be able to keep secrets. Where do you draw the line on this?
You start, I think, with the idea that the government should show that some harm can be done or has been done by publishing particular material. Even then, I have some real doubts whether a publisher should be punished for publishing material like that. There are penalties, as Manning found out, there are penalties for disclosing material like that to the press if it is secret. But most Australians, I think, are aware of Assange primarily because of collateral murder. Mm. How many Australians actually support the idea that he should be punished for that? How many people support the idea that what was shown in collateral murder was properly kept secret by the American government? That's the real question. Mm. You know, sure, okay, have laws if you like, which protect information, but be very careful about what sort of information is protected by the law.
Scott?
There are very well-recognised limitations on publication. So public interest immunity grounds. You're not meant to report, for example, on some elements of court procedures that are underway. You're not meant to publish matters of genuine national security that could put people's lives at risk. What we've seen over the last decade and a half are the expansion, particularly of this national security ground, to cover anything that could potentially embarrass governments. The bugging of the East Timorese cabinet rooms by Australian spies in the 1990s and then going after whistleblowers and their legal counsel right up until the present day, that's all being justified under national security grounds, when in fact what it's protecting is commercial espionage on behalf of the gas industry. We've got to, I think, take a good hard look at what governments are using this phrase national security to protect things that might just be politically embarrassing or actively criminal, and draw those lines much more tightly. What's considered to be national security material is actually just very large-scale mass murder, war crimes, and criminal activity.
We look back, Jen, at the Pentagon Papers that Dan Ellsberg released, and it is seen from the position of history now as an incredibly important moment in time. What do you think the legacy of those WikiLeaks documents is and will be?
I think similarly to what we've seen with the Pentagon Papers, people will look back in years to come and see Julian as a hero, as a principled person who took a very brave decision to publish information that the public had the right to know. In fact, we had Daniel Ellsberg, the famous Pentagon Papers leaker, come and give evidence for Julian in his extradition case. And one of the things Dan Ellsberg spoke so passionately about before the court was how when he first came out with the Pentagon Papers, he was vilified in the media, attacked by the president. And in the end, his case was thrown out because of the abuses that were perpetrated against him by the government, including spying on his psychiatrist. Dan made the comparison between him and Julian Assange, saying, back then I was vilified, but now I'm a hero, and Julian will be the same. People ask me all the time, why do you defend this case? Why have you, you know, stuck with it so long? And my answer is this. One, he is an Australian citizen and a client who deserves protection to the best of my ability. But also, this case has massive free speech implications. And we will look back on this time as Australians and think, how on earth did we allow the person who won the Walkley Award for most outstanding contribution for journalism and the man who has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for years and years on end for those publications to remain in prison as long as we did? It is absurd and it is unjust, and history will reflect poorly on this time.
Scott, you think, you're inclined to think that there is some light at the end of the tunnel here. What gives you a glimmer of hope at the moment?
That the campaign is as strong as it's been in a decade. And I think at the beginning of the year, when he won his legal case due to the work of, you know, the incredibly talented legal team and with enormous persistence, I thought, well, surely now this has to come to an end. Trump is gone and Julian won. It's been a struggle during the year to realize that the Biden administration is just going to carry on. But I still think that there's a chance they will look at where this is heading and change course. Honestly, I don't necessarily have faith in these institutions, but I do have faith in a grassroots campaign that needs to raise the volume, raise our voices so that the politicians can hear us.
You hear that there was a moment when Trump was entertaining pardoning Julian Assange. And also, I understand, Jen, that there was a delegation of Trump's that came and visited Julian, correct me if I'm wrong, at the Ecuadorian embassy, canvassing the possibility that if he fessed up to who the source was for the Democratic National Committee email leak, that they might be open to pardoning him.
Well, that's right. I was actually asked to give evidence in the extradition proceedings explaining, because I was there at the meeting with Julian when Congressman Rohrabacher came to the embassy to meet with him. And as I said in my witness statement before the court, basically said, look, if you reveal your source for the DNC leaks, then which would solve a problem for President Trump, then that will result in a pardon for you. Now, of course, Julian would never reveal a source because that is the number one protection that WikiLeaks offers. And in fact, journalists in line with their journalistic ethics wouldn't do the same. But you know, we have seen a huge amount of, this case is so heavily politicized, and it has been since the very beginning, public statements being made from very high profile politicians in the United States, here in Australia, about Julian's conduct, what they think should happen to him. But we are in a completely different position right now. And it's worth saying that it was very close for Julian getting a pardon just prior to Donald Trump leaving office. We were very close to getting him a pardon. And had the Australian government picked up the phone, I think we would have got one. He would be out of prison today. Instead, we won a case in January, and 10 months later, he remains in a high security prison, even though we won the case. I think this is a case of punishment by process. What the Australian public need to understand, if this appeal goes on, we could be in the appeal courts for the next several years or longer in the United Kingdom alone. If we are unsuccessful in this appeal, he will be extradited to the United States, held in oppressive prison conditions until such time as his criminal trial is heard, and then we have to appeal all the way to the Supreme Court on constitutional grounds. That is the end of his life. He will have spent two decades in prison fighting this. It is absolutely unacceptable that a publisher is being put through this process, and that the Australian government has the ability to put an end to it.
Yes, nobody could accuse him of not paying a heavy price, Jen, for upholding his principles of radical transparency and accountability. You know, he is, by all accounts, unwell and in a dreadful prison situation. He is, as you say, separated from his partner and his children. Do you think he has any regrets? Would he, in retrospect, have done anything differently, do you think? Has he communicated that to you, or does he remain as strongly committed as ever?
I wouldn't want to speculate on any regrets that Julian might have. The WikiLeaks material has been absolutely invaluable to human rights lawyers around the world in holding governments to account. we had evidence in his extradition case about how important the WikiLeaks disclosures were in relation to Guantanamo Bay and ensuring that the grave injustice of Guantanamo Bay was exposed. European Court of Human Rights cases, International Court of Justice cases, human rights cases around the world. I don't even know how to convey the extent of the injustice in this case in words.
What you just said, Jen, explains perfectly what is going on. Governments have been embarrassed, they have been hurt, and they want to punish that because they can. I mean, he is just being punished because he has held governments to account.
Up until quite recently, the only support that Assange could get from major party politicians would be after they'd left office. So Kevin Rudd, very strong after he left office. Bob Carr, after he left office. What I think is quite significant about what Mr. Albanese has done, and that he was backed by quite a strongly worded party resolution, a lay party resolution, not long after his comments, is that he's still in office. I think that gives us a certain amount of hope that this very stale and deadlocked bipartisanship that has prevailed for a decade has finally broken. My call on the leader of the opposition is for action now to back it up. We can't afford to wait for a federal election, which might be months away. Every single day of that delay, Julian is still in Belmarsh prison. So the time for action is now, whenever the election may be. It's all hands on deck.
But is there much he can do as opposition leader?
Go to the National Press Club and talk about the significance of this case. Put out a press statement. Talk back channels, if necessary, with Democratic colleagues in the United States. Come to public meetings. Come on the ABC. Talk it up. There's a campaign afoot. And this is not a place for spectators.
And maybe he could persuade Rupert Murdoch, the other great Australian publisher, to speak out and say what needs to be said about Assange.
And finally to you, Jen, does Julian Assange retain much hope that he will be freed?
I think we all have the hope that he will be free and soon, and that's what keeps us all going. It's been more than a decade, but I do think that we are closer and closer to getting him out. Having won the decision in January, now having all of the major Australian parties on side and a commitment from the cabinet of the current Labor opposition to put an end to this if they come to power, I think it would actually be a political coup for whichever Australian leader were able to negotiate the end of this case, which has been one of the most long-running and controversial matters between our two nations. Well, three, in fact, the United States, the UK and Australia. And so I do think that the leader who is able to put an end to this could call this and would be celebrated for a massive political win. And so I do hope that that's the way in which our current Australian Prime Minister and any future Australian Prime Minister would see it.
And that's where we'll have to leave our discussion. I was talking with Jen Robinson, lawyer for Julian Assange and barrister at Doughty Street Chambers in London, barrister Julian Burnside QC, and Scott Ludlam, formerly a senator and deputy leader of the Australian Greens. Thanks to the Melbourne Writers' Festival, where this discussion was meant to occur, for their help.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers' Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.